session of February 16, 1977. First of all, an announcement. Next week, we don't meet. There's a break. We don't meet until March 2nd. Another announcement. I was told of a novel about living together. It's the novel by Gorky, titled Summer Folk. It's about intellectuals spending the summer in a dacha. Last time I stopped at the entry room, individual room, not the marital room. It's the Kellyon or the Kella. To talk about this room, I had suggested to speak about the total space, the sacred space. In the Bible, there were three architectural forms: the tent, the pavilion, the dwelling. The tabernacle is the Ark of the Covenant. There would be an autarkic economy there. The tabernacle is in the desert. It's called skene. Skene in Greek. Means a tent, a pavilion, a shelter for actors. It's the tent in which the Ark of the Covenant has been placed. It's also a shelter for actors. This is my thematic idea. The thematic idea in the tabernacle, the idea of an empty space in the middle, around which you have a number of dwellings for the 12 tribes who are spread out around the tabernacle. Different groups spread around an uninhabited center. This is the very principle of idiorhythmic organizations. Rather than organizations, I'd like a less voluntary term, like constellations. For instance, in the desert of Nitria, in the mountain Athos, in the Beguinage, in the structure of Port-Royal, we find the same empty center. In the Christian world, it's the church. Around this empty center, people meet, eat, and live. The skene is what I wanted to describe as the prototype of the room in the idiorhythmic sense. And then there is the third after Noah's Ark, the desert tabernacle, we have the Temple of Jerusalem. This is the Temple of Solomon plus Ezekiel's two visions. There is here a fantasy of the total building. The Solomon's Temple is where priests lived, and the Palace of Jerusalem. It's like a huge convent, an early model of the monastic structure, an exclusive, total, multifunctional space. The Temple of Jerusalem has inspired many architectural buildings. For instance, the palace for some French kings is the historical embodiment of the temple. Some among you know this. For instance, in Spain, the Escorial, not far from Madrid. This was the result of a vow made by Philip II just after the Battle of Saint-Quentin. You see a mention of this vow in the building. The date is important, August 10th, 1557. The palace was to be orientated on the axis of the sun's set on August 10, which is St. Lawrence Day. This is why, because of St. Lawrence, the building is in the shape of a gridiron. There is a very rich symbolical meaning here. The second architect, named Herrera, his work has been theorized by Villalpanda. He himself was a follower of Raymond Lull. In the Escorial, you find all sorts of sacred calculations. The hub is the temple with the tribes around the tabernacle. It's both a monastery, a palace, and a church. Here are the sacred forms of the building. Now that we are progressing towards the room, we have to go down a bit. To see how the room becomes isolated within the house. The room is detached from the total space. Here the room and the house are no longer interchangeable. The room becomes an autonomous symbolic space. It culminates with the conjugal bedroom. This will be a huge file, of course. I'm just indicating a number of files here. The file will be about the links between conjugality and property. Indeed, when the room becomes the conjugal bedroom, there is a room belonging to the husband and the wife, who are father and mother, and they are master and mistress. In the archaic civilizations, it's a protected space, it's secret. Secret calls up the Freudian primal scene. It is also the place of the treasure. The room is a storehouse for the most valuable things. It would be interesting to propose a relation between the scene, secrecy, and property. We have a good image of the conjugal room as the economy of the rural domain in Xenophon's book. Which is the point of view of the land-owning gentry. He wrote his Economicus. Economy refers to the room. In Greek, the conjugal room is called ο θάλαμος. You find it in Homer. THALAMOS. What's interesting is that the word thalamos means also a shop, then only a room to sleep in. The thalamos is placed in the most private part of the house. And you also have the women's quarters. This is where the most precious possessions were stored, like coverings, precious furniture. Even today, a survey could be carried out about the conjugal chest. At least I'd be interested by the results of this survey. In today's culture, I'd like to know what happens to this conjugal chest. It can be the place for a certain treasure deposited in the bedroom. Can be just a place in the room, like an armoire. There should be a sociology of the armoire. And then we can see the list of objects that will be deposited. Money, checkbooks, passports, IDs. I'm not going to call up my own grandmother, but indeed, at my grandparents, in the house of my father's mother, there was a big armoire, and it was stuffed with everything that would be precious. Anything that was precious was there. These are things that could be stolen. You had in a sort of chaos little silver spoons, sugar, jam. This is again a new file to open. This is an idea for some investigation. And you see the ecology of architecture there, in the heart of property. You have something like sexual rights. You have an entire mythical structure with all the themes about the hidden room, the secret room, the room of blue beard. That would be the second level. The thalamos. The thalamos is also the treasure room. The third point is when the room loses its association with the couple. It becomes a pure individual cell, a cella. We will find the word monakos. It's a single room for a single person who is a bachelor. The cella in Latin is a cell, in fact. Well, just a few words about this individual room. The first cella is the hut of the hermit in the desert. And when Pacôme founded convents for the first time, at that time they had cells. The Pacônian convent had no dormitories. The origin of the cell is this convent. This cella is a representation of interiority, whence its ambivalence, the double value. On the one hand, that cell is considered as a space to battle whatever is dangerous. The anachoret will fight against the devil single-handedly. It's called the certamen anachoretale in Latin, the hand-to-hand combat of the anachoret with the enemy. Solus cum solo is the battle with the devil. There is the second side. The cell represents a calming interiority. the cell appeases. The camera has a pacifying function. That's what one says of the monks. Quella continuata dulcescit. Pacifies. I immediately quote Rilke, that you can transpose what Rilke writes. He writes, deep within himself, he carried the obscurity, the refuge, and the tranquility of a house. This is, of course, symbolical. We have the interiority of the mind, and the room is historically ambivalent. On the one hand, it gives you what you want to escape from, as Pascal said, all unhappiness springs from not knowing how to stay quiet in one's room. We want to go out of the room. In a more literary domain, it's what Flaubert called marinade, where he would face sterility and fight against it. This is also a symbol of life, of shelter, not having a room of one's own leads to a teenage rite of passage. To have a room of one's own is a sign of maturity. The secular version of the interiority of the room, if we take it as a value, we call this the cantassoi, that is reserve, a distant attitude. The individual room is a place for cantasfabulation, the fantasy of pure reserve. It's of course not subjected to surveillance. In some families, one has to fight for a room, similar to the fight for freedom. In some way, the room represents an anti-gregarious element, it may lead to a pure will to power, a la Nietzsche. What destroys the reserve of the room is perceived as an instrument of power. Power needs transparency. Let's think of today's architectural doctrine. We see this in Beaubourg, Centre Pompidou Museum. The architect made a plan with a very great open hall, vast open plan. There are no partitions, everything can be seen. And it's the American architect, Richard Rogers, who did this. the principle of transparency. Transparency does away with surveillance, since everyone keeps a watch over everyone else. And it's the most profitable use of space. This transparency is thus an instrument by which the room representing interiority is destroyed. Interiority can be spiritual interiority or material interiority. Therefore, there's this problem. Does the cell, the kella, the individual room, does it have to be luxurious? Historically speaking, this problem is not relevant. The monastic cells in Christianity were traversed by marks of asceticism, poverty. In Zola's novel, one of his best, The Conquest of Plassans, we see the bedroom of Abbé Faugas. This abbé is a big pusher, and one sees what is revealed by his room. It's in fact, as you know, the town of Aix-en-Provence. That's the basis for Plassans. One day, the narrator manages to see this room. Mouret is a burning curiosity for it. It has no decoration, nothing personal. There's nothing left around. To leave things lying around suggests sensuousness, something that leads to voluptuousness. The whole room of this abbey is described as bare. There was not a single paper on the table, not an article of any kind on the chest of drawers, not a garment hanging against the walls. The wood was bare, the marble was bare, the walls were bare. We are used to that idea of bareness in Western buildings. It's not like that in other places of the world. For instance, in Buddhist monasteries in Ceylon, the cells betray comfort and a degree of luxury. You see a few cushions, small blankets, white, everything is clean, white, a few books, a radio, a few photographs. It's a little like the cell that Charlie Chaplin inhabits in modern times. This room is marked by a kind of Epicureanism. One needs not to have too much, but what you have is good quality. The problem of the room's social standing, it would not be relevant here. What matters is the idea of structure. What is relevant is the fact that the kella has total autonomy over its structure. The room is its own structure. It's distinct from any contiguous structures. Of course, the room is always structured to a greater or lesser degree in that way. There is a constellation, a loose local constellation, a supple network in this topology of the room. The bed to sleep, the desk to work, and places to store personal effects. Such a structure exists almost always. It exists in each of us. It can be transported somewhere else. It can be transported to different countries. One can reconstitute it, irrespective of the objects themselves. The building functions in exactly the same way. This is a structured room. If it is structured like my usual room, it recreates the same network of relations . You only need the same relationship between the table, the bed, and the armoire. This kind of meditation can make us meditate on Gide's room. I will talk more about her, the confined woman of Poitiers. She has been sequestered by the family. It's a room that this poor woman never leaves, a bed, in fact. She never leaves the bed. When they come into this room, they saw a very destructured room. She had been for 25 years on that bed. The room is literally reduced to a bed. The bed can become the basic unit for the room. We see this in hospitals, in a sanatorium. The subject is reduced to that structure. It's a very comfortable structure, the bed. Aunt Leonie's bed, which is her bedroom. She has a table next to it with a few objects, a bedside table. Aunt Leonie's bedroom is a structure. For the confined woman of Poitiers, the bed was the structure. The rest was absolutely unstructured. Everything was thrown in the bedroom, debris, broken objects. It's the space of confinement. The police describes it. A commode with no drawers, 4 empty bottles, 3 cans of food, a lotto set, 2 small cabinets, a couch piled with rags and tatters, crawling with vermin, a doll's head, a rosary, 5 pencil stubs. This is what is important. From her bed, the subject can produce a non-structure. The subject can destructure the rest of the room. The luxury of the room is not the luxury of objects, but an utter lack of structure. Mélanie, the sequestered woman, exercises every kind of power over a room, even that of destructuring, and that structure is independent of the house structure. In the historical representations, we have something like a body of representations connected with the bedroom. It is an architecture that denies or destroys the quant à soi, pure interiority. There was a historical debate in arts and architecture between those who followed the example of Rome and those who followed the Greeks. Greek architecture, like the Parthenon, was a hut. There's a house there. There was a debate raging between those who wanted to imitate Greek ruins and those who wanted Roman ruins. There's this engraver. This debate impacts Piranesi. His prisons are supposed to represent an anti-hut. It's against a hut, against a room. If you remember, there are very vast anti-cellular structures. They are constituted by a demonic capsizing of all levels. It's the reverse of interiority. Piranesi is the space of crisis, of drama, of the sublime. The word of Piranesi . There's the sublime here. The sublime defined by Burke, and you find it in Piranesi. It's a violent critique of interiority, of the quant à soi, which would be the fantasy of the bedroom as pure interiority. There is a passionate agitation in those prisons, jails. In Italian, all this has got a name, which is magnificenza. Magnificenza is the space of emotional agitation, of ornamental and historical transparency. Now, the entry chief. So I repeat myself a little. Historically speaking, it's the move from Eremitism to Cenobitism. Pacomius did that in Egypt in 314. He was the first to found the living together. That's the first model. The Pacomian living together will immediately be marked, immediately, by Pacom. It introduces a hierarchy. It's the invention of the chief at the same time. Let's be clear on the following. Anachoretism is not characterized by solitude. You have groups of anachorites. They are not solitary. But this is characterized by the absence of a chief. In the colonies of anachorites, you have no chief. There is an opposition between idiorhythmy and cenobitism. The opposition is not between solitude and community, but a group with no chief versus a group with a chief. In the monasteries founded by Pacomius, the first rule is obedience to the chief. There's one chief for every house of monks. It's called the praepositus, A.E. Whence, in the West, the two fundamental features, the defining features of the monk, is a subject placed under an abbot's command, and his table. He is happy living his whole life in a single unchanging environment. This is the brutal and ground that led to an ideological and symbolical evolution. In the West, Saint Benedict has made this progression possible. The abbot is the pivot of the monastery. He is a chief in the historical sense. He stands for Christ, Pater et Magister, the vicar of Christ. The telos of this abbatial institution, in its symbolic elaboration, is not at all the observation of rules. One is not there to respect the rules, but the telos is the salvation of souls. The line of descent that follows the ecclesiastic model. This doesn't come from the Roman image of the family, the pater familias, but from the model of the bishop and the diocese. This symbolic elaboration of the Benedictine type leads to a relevant opposition between two types of charisma, of charismatic power. It's very old. You have this in all Indo-European languages. One can see this in Benveniste's very important book. In Greek, you had an opposition between two words that define two symbolic functions. There is, first, the word about somebody who wields power. It's anax. You find this in Homer. Anax. It's the chief who holds the key to power. And then there is Basileus, translated by king. But the Basileus, unlike Anax, is a sort of god. He has a magical religious function. His sign is the scepter, the messenger staff transmitting authorized speech. This is the Basileus. Here you can oppose two types of charisma, the temporal meaning, the chief, anax, and the oriental type of charisma. This is the head of a sect, the elder, the guru, who has a lot of symbolic prestige and he is more a model. The second type of chief is really the guru, it's precisely this type, the guru, that is intrinsically compatible with idiorhythmic constellations. It's not a colony around an abbey, a chief, but it's around a model, an elder, not a leader. You had a projection of images. It's not power, not authority. There is a degree of self-evidence here. The self-evidence of the guru is crucial. He cannot be elected. Yeah, you had a sub-evidence. For the election of a chief to be unanimous, you would need a process of becoming a guru. This is the problem of the elections in a monastery. You need almost overwhelming unanimity, or at least 99% majority. all the conversations, have to reach this overwhelming majority. The charismatic example needs everybody to agree. We see this in Rousseau's social contract, the unanimous election. One could also meditate on the idea of election, what would happen if the chief of state was elected by 99% of the vote. The 1% would be a concession to the sacred. He would not be a guru. Would still be secular. The dividing line between the chief, anarchs, and the guru has been given by Bion, the English author I've already quoted. The third objective of the group, the third basic assumption for Bion, the third telos, after dependency and pairing, is the hypothesis that I am interested in of fight and flight. The group meets to confront an outside threat or to run away from it, to flee it. The leader is somebody whose exigencies provide the group with opportunities for flight or fight. The leader is the person who gives to the group the possibilities of fleeing. Bion says, leaders who neither fight nor run away are not easily understood. A leader who doesn't attack or doesn't run cannot be understood, but this corresponds to the second charismatic type, the guru. It's somebody who, as a chief, will neither fight nor flee. This is also why he is not a leader. The second type of chief is just somebody who makes decisions. Let me give two examples here. You know this novel. I thought I would use it. It's very rich. It's a hard novel. Golding's Lord of the Flies. You know, the story of a group of children on an island. It's a deserted island and they survive. They get organized. At the beginning, there is Ralph, who becomes the leader. He says, seems to me we ought to have a chief to decide things. They all scream, a chief. I ought to be chief, said Jack with simple arrogance, because I'm chapter chorister and I am head boy. I can sing like the chanteur de la Croix de Bois. I can sing C sharp, he says. The second example is in the Magic Mountain. The chief is the doctor. He makes the decisions and gives no explanation for them. We had once worked on this kind of discourse, the medical discourse. There is no explanation given. If you take a plane, you have the helpers and you have the attendants who are the same. They don't give any explanation. This is how, I quote, Hans Castorp went to bed on the Saturday afternoon as had been ordained by Hofrat Behrens, the highest authority in our little world. This is how, at the opposite extreme, there's an opposition between this and the guru, who takes no decisions, neither fights nor flees. We see this in the Tao. This is how I will quote two quotes from the Tao. They circumscribe the problem of the second charismatic type. You find this in the idiorhythmic groups. The wise man does not fight. And this is the guru. Do not fight. And then, Tao offers no difficulty except that it avoids choosing. I'm not going to start a new entry. It will be for next time, next meeting in 2 weeks.